Okay, please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Dan McHugh from Wilmington, Delaware.
My name is Dan McHugh. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. Wow, this meeting is growing. Got like an amphitheater out there now. I've been up here a couple times. I appreciate getting asked back. Oftentimes in the summer, I like Hawaiian shirts, and the uglier the better. So I always wear an ugly Hawaiian shirt, but every time I come up here, Dave has an even uglier one on. I don't know how he does it every time. Ah, well. I live in Wilmington, Delaware. My home group is the Fresh Air Group. Meets Monday nights at Green Hill Presbyterian down there. I haven't had a drink of alcohol in a little over 17 years now. I'm grateful for that. I know when we get asked to talk to the membership, we're asked to talk about what it was like and what happened and what's it like now. My what it was like, I have a very boring story. I just don't have one of those really neat. I like going to conferences where you hear those really cool stories, you know, and exciting things. Had I known I'd get to talk so much, I would have done more stuff. But I just, you know, I didn't. I just don't have one of those stories. So if you listen to me, I'm probably going to talk a little bit more about what happened when I got here than beforehand, because I just don't want to put you all to sleep. A few years ago, I had what I still think is a great idea, and I wrote New York and asked them if they would consider changing the rules of AA. And bear with me. Here's what I thought. After you get to like a certain amount of sobriety, say 15 years or 20 years or whatever, I mean, let's think about it for a minute. When we tell our stories, we're telling our stories as we remember them. So they're probably not very accurate. You know, if we had like our Al-Anon counterparts come in here and tell our stories, different thing. So I figure since, well, what we're talking about isn't true anyway, what I'd like to do is that like 15 years or 20, you can make up a new one. All right? And so you'd like go around to conferences and listen to the best speakers and take little pieces of their story, the best stuff, and then just make up an even better one. Just beat them by a little bit. You know, so when, you know, the guy that comes up here and I spent 27 years in the penitentiary, 31. Right? Wrecked 7 cars. 12. You know, just beat them a little bit. I wrote them through. They haven't written back yet. I'm sure any time I'll get a response. But anyway, I just don't have one. I'm just one of these drunks that I started drinking young. I'm from an Irish Catholic family. My father is Irish Catholic, and my mother is Cherokee Indian. I'm just a drunk waiting to happen. All right? I'm the 5th of 5 brothers, and every one of us seemed to have this problem. My oldest brother drank himself to death at a very young age. My next brother drank himself into a nut hut at a very young age. One brother walked away from it. I don't know how he did it, but he just walked away from it. And I have one still out there living that life, and I don't know what's going to happen to him. I already have one child. My oldest daughter is now in the program, 4.5 years sober. I have a son who I hope you'll get to meet soon, because he is one of us. I have two others that they kind of took the Al-Anon way, you know, and they just run around fixing everybody else, but they don't seem to have any problems. I got to quit doing that Al-Anon. I shouldn't pick on Al-Anoners. I mean, really, without us, you know? Without us, where would they be? You know? I don't know. So I'm drinking pretty high. I start drinking, I don't know, probably in elementary school. And by the time I'm about a junior in high school, I'm pretty much a daily drinker already. I didn't know that was all that unusual. I'm hanging out with people who drink like I do. I didn't realize that thinking about drinking all the time and drinking to the excess that I did was all that unusual. I didn't know. I can remember back in maybe 10th grade on a Wednesday afternoon in chemistry class, and I'm sitting there looking forward to the Friday night dance. Now, not knowing that the guy next to me is looking forward to the Friday night dance because maybe he'll meet a nice girl, maybe he'll get to dance and hear great music, I'm seeing a drinking opportunity coming. And that's the way I thought about alcohol my whole life. I just thought about it all the time. It eventually became all I had in life as my world shrunk and shrunk. And I also didn't know, you take somebody like me, you put a little bit of alcohol in me, and I always want more. I always want more. I drank that way from day one. I know some people didn't. Some people progressed into it. Some only drink periodically. I'm one of these guys that drinks every day, and I always have to have more and more and more. And I did not know what was wrong with me that made me that way. I figured what other people were telling me, I'm no good. I'm a lousy dad, I'm a lousy husband, I'm a lousy father, I'm a lousy neighbor, I'm a lousy employer, I'm a lousy employee. What else could it be? I had all reasons to the contrary not to live that way. You know, I had a family business going, I had these little children. I always laugh about the kids because, you know, it's a Catholic family. And I just come home from another drunk and there'd be another baby there periodically. Just, I don't know where they came from, I don't remember making them. Just like down in a row like this. But I ignored it. My children came to be scared to death of me. And there came a point in my time late in my drinking that I brought physical harm to one of those kids. And I don't know that I'll ever get over that, but that's a story for another day. He's the drunk today, as a matter of fact. Just in a drunken rage. My drinking continued. My world shrunk. Now, I'm one of these folks, and maybe you can identify, that before things got really crazy, I'm at work, and I'm just going to go out after work and have a few beers. That's all we're going to do. I'm just going to go out and have a few beers with some of the fellows at work. That was my intention. Go home at a decent hour, go to work tomorrow. So I'd go out to the bar, and a couple of people would have a couple of drinks, and they'd start using these excuses. You've all heard them. They sound insane. Got to go. Got to work tomorrow. We can't have any more. I'm driving. And I'm thinking, what does that have to do with anything? Got to pick the kids up. I don't have to pick the kids up. Got to mow the grass. All these different reasons. I had all kinds of reasons to the contrary not to stay there and drink. But I kept drinking. And I kept drinking. And I never understood why until I got here. And folks in rooms like this one taught me what alcoholism was, as Alcoholics Anonymous understands alcoholism. And for the first time in my life, I finally saw what was wrong with me. And I'll get to that in a little bit. I drink, and little by little, everybody's leaving. The family packs up and goes. The companies, I actually quit my own company. I just stopped going. That's alcoholic, you know? Someone else will take care of that. I just stopped going. All heck hit. So I'm on a final tear, and I'm figuring, well, I'm just going to drink myself to death. Just going to drink myself to death. And I set out to do that. It's very difficult to do, I found out. And to this day, I don't know what made me do it, but for some point, after about 7 days of this, I was really very, very, very sick, malnourished. I was probably a dying man very soon. I got the phone book out, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I always laugh. I always say, thank God it's in there under AA. You know, because if you're coming off a 7-day tear and trying to spell Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'd be up here tonight if that were the case. But I call them, and they come, and they get me, and they take me to a detox. Now, I don't know anything about recovery. I don't know anything about AA. I don't know what a detox is. If any of you know the Wilmington area, we have a place called Kirkwood Highway Detox. I don't know if we have any alumni in here from Kirkwood Highway Detox. It's not a real nice place. Not a real nice place. So I get in there. I'm sick as a dog. I'm 118 pounds soaking wet, malnourished, drunk as a skunk, been sitting in my drawers, not cleaning myself, anything for over a week. And I walk in there, and I look around, and I say, my God, I don't belong in here. It's been some kind of a mistake. You should have seen the folks they had in there. So I went up to the front and I said, I'm sorry, there's been a mistake. I don't really belong here. I have to leave. And now I didn't know at that point in time in 93 in Delaware, when you go into one of these places, you sign this little form. You're signing yourself in for 72 hours. They lock the doors behind you. And the lady said, no, you're right where you need to be, and I beg to disagree. So I look down the hallway, and I notice way down at the end of the hallway, way down there, nobody's down there, is one of these doors with the red panic bar thing across it. Well, I know enough that you're not allowed to lock those. So when nobody's looking, I take off down the hall, proving that I didn't belong there. I I take off down the hall, and I smash through that door, and the alarms are going off, and the white coats are chasing me, right? And I look around, and there's this huge fence all around the area. I'd broken into the smoking corner. This is big fence, maybe like 12 foot high. I don't really know how high it is, but the longer I'm sober, the higher it gets. It's high, probably 13 feet. And there's the sharp stuff on the top, you know, and the alarms are going on the white coats, and I said, I got to get out of here. And I climbed up to the top of that fence, grabbed that sharp stuff, threw my leg up on the top, and launched myself to freedom. It's beautiful. The landing. The landing didn't work out too well. I swear, when I hit that ground, it felt like my legs were just being shoved up through my shoulders. I had multiple fractures in my lower legs. My left heel exploded into a gabillion pieces. My hands are all ripped to shreds. So I fall back on the ground, and something happened. And I don't know if I heard this with my ears, I don't know if I heard it with my heart, I don't know if I heard it in my head, but I distinctly heard a voice say, "It's over." Here's the thing. I've never had a desire to take a drink of alcohol since that second. 17 years ago, for a daily drunk like me. No higher power out there, some people will say. I don't know about that one. The pain briefly left me. I felt exhilarated. I can't describe it. Then the pain came back. They put me over in Christiana Hospital. They didn't know what to do with me, so they strapped me down. I was pretty sick and went through the DTs and all kinds of fun things. I'll shorten that little part. It's not very pretty. And I ended up in a rehab. Went to a rehab. I'm really grateful for that place. It kind of put me back on my feet physically, taught me a few things, and they said, when you leave here, this is just the beginning, not the end. You got a little bit of information now. Go to AA, and they'll teach you how to live sober. That's what they told me. I didn't know anything about AA, but I started coming. Little wheelchair, you know, rolling around in my wheelchair. I'm suddenly an advocate for ADA compliancy, you know, when I go up to a church. And can't get in there. And then, of course, eventually I progress to my little crutches, and I'm standing in the meetings and sitting in the meetings, and I start learning about Alcoholics Anonymous. I get a sponsor. I always like telling this if you're new, because I had an idea. They told me what a sponsor is. Somebody's going to teach me the program and all that. Teach me life. Teach me how to be a man. So I knew what kind of sponsor I wanted. I wanted to drive a Mercedes, successful man, well-respected in the community, shirt and tie, Italian, probably nice shoes. That's not who I got. I got this 6'4", former biker, covered with tattoos from ear to ear, metal things sticking out, hair everywhere, and he came up to me and said, "I'm going to be your sponsor." I said, "Oh, no, 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 no." They told me in rehab that I get to pick my own sponsor. I was pretty sure I could take him. I was probably up to 124, 125 pounds by then. He said, "We're going to meet over at my house once a week, and I'm going to show you the big book of Alcoholics." I didn't know what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was, but he said, "That's where we put our program." He says, "We have two tremendous powers available to you should you want to take advantage of them." This is right out of the gate. He said, "We have a fantastic fellowship, this thing, and we gather in meetings and we support one another. And then we have an even bigger power available to us, a process to get us in connection with some power greater than ourselves, which can solve our alcohol problem." It was all gibberish to me, but now I know what he was talking about, and I did what he suggested because I was desperate. He told me, "I'm going to show you how to go from desperation to inspiration." And that's exactly what he did. And we sat in his house week after week after week. There was four men, four of us. The two other fellows didn't fare so well. One's deceased now, and one's back out there, in and out, in and out. I did exactly what my sponsor asked me to do, and I got exactly the result he said that he got and that I would get if I followed it. So when I get an opportunity to get in front of a bunch of people, that's all I can do is tell you what I did and what happened for me, and then we all get to decide for ourselves whether it makes any sense. The first thing he said, Dan, he goes, "You've told me your story." He said, "Let me tell you a little bit about my drinking." Well, I said, "Go ahead." He goes, "I used to go out after work with a few guys, just going to have a couple beers. And I'd get out there and I'd find that they're coming up with reasons to go home and they have to pick up the kids and drive the car. He goes, and I'm always staying there, always wanted more, always wanted more. Always wanted the second drink more than the first and the third more than the second and the fourth more than the third and the fifth more than the fourth and so on and so on and so on. Because I never knew what was wrong with me and I'd be there till they closed the bar and I got arrested over and over and over and over and over again. He said, sometimes I would manage to stop drinking for some period of time, and even though I knew how bad it would be if I go back, I always went back. Always went back to it. He says, so you might say that when I'm drinking, I've got to keep drinking. And when I stop drinking, I always resume drinking. He says, so if you got to drink when you're drinking, and you got to drink when you're not drinking, you're powerless over alcohol. And he sat me down in the doctor's opinion in the big book, and he said, let's read what this guy says it's like when you put some of that stuff in your body. And I don't know about the language. I don't know about allergy. I don't know phenomenon of craving. I don't know any of that stuff. But what it said in that book made a lot of sense. You put some of that stuff in me, and I want some more. That described me to a T. It doesn't seem to happen to most people. Maybe one or two out of ten that seems to happen to. They can stop when given good reasons to do so. I can't. I don't seem to be able to do that. My body cannot drink. And he said, and also what doesn't happen to normal drinkers is when you're not drinking, it occurs to you that next time you'll be able to do it better. It always occurs to you, you'll be able to drink better next time. That doesn't happen to regular people either. And they don't sit in 10th grade chemistry class and obsess about drinking two nights later. Doesn't happen. So you drink abnormally with your mind too. He said, you got a body that can't drink and a mind that swears that it can, you're powerless over alcohol. And then he said something that stuck with me forever, and I love repeating it. Hope I don't offend anyone with the language. I guess it isn't that bad, and the church is pretty far away. He said, basically, here's your first step. You're screwed. You're screwed. I was offended. Screwed. He said, what are you going to do? What's going to happen here? You got to drink. And as soon as you start drinking, you got to keep drinking. You're absolutely screwed. And that is the first step for me in a nutshell. He said, you ever do anything in life that you make a decision to do something based on stuff that isn't true? I said, that's ridiculous. Why would I do that? He says, you know you can't drink, and yet you keep kicking up a drink, right? He goes, yeah. He says, so you're making a decision on something that isn't true, right? Yeah. You go out knowing full well you're not going to come home and do the things you said you're going to do, yet you still go do it, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're constantly making decisions in your life based on things that aren't true, aren't you? Yeah. He goes, if you're running around making life's decisions on lies, your life's going to be unmanageable. I said, wow, that makes a lot of sense. Started to sink in. I was screwed. But here's what I didn't know. If you're in AA, and you're screwed, you win. If I'm screwed, I got to do something about it. If I think maybe, I can still finagle it, I can still do this. When I was only interested in your second step because I was screwed. Suddenly came very, very attractive that you guys have a way out. Because I could look at Mike and say, Mike, you just described your drinking just the way I drank. You were screwed, but you're not anymore. What's happened? He says, believe it or not, I found out I didn't have the power to stop my own drinking. I said, okay. He goes, but I found the power to stop my own drinking. He goes, and we're going to sit you down and ask if you're willing to change your thinking around that based on our experience. Are you willing to take our second step based on our experience out here in the room? You willing to change your thinking around the fact that maybe some power can come into your life and save your butt too? Yeah, I'd like to hear about that. I'd really like to hear about that. That started to make a lot of sense, the second step then. Came to believe that a power greater than myself based on other people's experience. So he said, okay, and I love this. I love the Monty Hall thing. So over here, step one, screwed. Can't argue with it. Totally screwed. I'm going to get more screwed if something doesn't change. And over here, accept the way they did things, accept spiritual help, and get better. There's our choices. He said, no, we got another step called step three. Decide between those two. You want screwed? In the book it says it's a hard decision. It's the old joke, alcoholic death. You call your doctor, doc, just how bad is an alcoholic death, right? We want to know. So we want to know what we're weighing. So we got some data, and we decide between the two. Nobody's saying in the third step that I'm going to suddenly turn my will over to God, walk across the water, and go home. It doesn't say it, or we'd all be at a three-step meeting. Steps one, two, three, go home. Everybody's better. Doesn't work that way. But he said, just make a decision between these two that you're going to try it our way because we're not screwed anymore. That made a ton of sense to me. So I did that. I said, okay, I don't know about this higher power thing. I don't know. I'm raised a Catholic. And, you know, if you're Catholic, you know that we're not really allowed to have a relationship with God. All right? It's not what it's about. We got to work through other people to get there. With a checkbook. I only say that once in a while. 4 kids, 13 years each of Catholic schooling, so I guess I can say that, get away with it. That's why I can only afford shirts like that. I don't know what his excuse is. He said he paid $3 for that. I think he got ripped off for 2 of them. Where were we? AA. So I say to Mike, I don't know about this whole God thing. He goes, there is a God. It's already there. He said to me, and this is going to sound nuts to some of you probably, but he said, you ever see people, I'm all over the place, you ever see folks who say, I don't get the spiritual part of the program? And you always kind of snicker. You know, I don't get the spiritual part of the program. And Mike used to say to me, well, there isn't anything that isn't spiritual in our program. And if you want to test that theory, when you go home tomorrow night, you go to your meeting tomorrow and you're chairing, make your topic non-spiritual parts of AA. You'll have a Quaker meeting. There'll be nothing to talk about. There isn't any non-spiritual part. And he said to me, he said, Dan, you got all the spirituality you're ever going to need, and all the God, higher power, spirit, divine, whatever you want to call it, that's already there too. So the problem isn't spirituality or getting some spirituality, and the problem certainly isn't the abundance of this divine power, whatever it is. Something's going on. Here's what he said to me. Makes sense. He said, Dan, you're about to do something. And out of nowhere, a little voice says, don't do that. Ever heard? First one who laughs always, I know. It means he's got a long list of them. Right? But you know that little, you're just about to, and you're like, where did that come from? Or we do something, and then we're going home, and out of nowhere, this little voice says, why did you do that? And I got you that time, huh? She said it before I did. We need a 5th step down front. So we, or later, I wish I hadn't have done that. And it's almost like a two-way conversation. Like, where did that come? Mike said, does that happen to you? I said, yeah, it happens to me all the time. He says, we call that an unconscious contact with God. God's already there. 100%. Change the word if you'd like, just the word I'm comfortable with. But that power is already there. And every now and again, it tends to sneak in. Don't do that. Why'd you do that? Almost sounds like guidance, doesn't it? Sneaking in out of nowhere. And I said, well, Mike, I get that. I said, but what does that have to do with my alcohol? He goes, that's what we use to change ourselves so that we don't drink alcohol anymore. I said, I don't get it. He goes, that voice is always there. I said, not for me. It just pops out now and again, like randomly. What do I do about that? He goes, well, why can't you hear it all the time? I said, I don't know. Something's blocking it. He said, glad you said that. You ever do that with your sponsor? You say it and you know you want to take it back. He said, we got a step for that. He said, we're going to sit down with some pieces of paper and try to figure out what's blocking you. You agree the power's already there, right? Well, yeah, I can't argue with that. You agree all you have all the spirituality you ever need in the world? Sorry, yeah, I can't agree with that. And something's blocking it. We're going to do a little thing we call the inventory. And we're going to try to write down some stuff from your life and try to figure out what it is that's blocking you from getting this very strong signal that we're all getting. It made perfect sense to me. He didn't say we're going to make a list of all the dirtiest, rotten things you've ever done. We're going to write down all those gas stations you robbed. I didn't really rob any of them, but I stole that from another store that I heard somewhere else. So we're going to make a list of all this stuff, and we're going to try to get some sense on what is it about you or about your thinking that's blocking you. What's guiding you now? I said, well, I don't know what's guiding me now. He said, there are probably hundreds and hundreds of guiding forces in your life right now. I said, name one. Never say name one to your sponsor. I never do that. But he used the tailgater example, and I love the tailgater experience. Is there anyone in this room who has been tailgated? Right? And first hand up. Over. As soon as we start getting tailgated, what do? We give that tailgater all the power in the world, don't we? Hit the brake, hit the speed up, slow down, change lane, bump, 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 right? We're cussing them out, right? And today, and we look in our rearview mirror, and this is all you see. Right? My son's like 6'5", and he can get all the way down in a car, and all you see is like this. I don't even know where he is under there. My car's got pedals and stuff under there. But he gets all the way down there. It's like, how shiftless can I look right now? You know? Anyways, good boy. Tailgater. Simple, silly little example of how something in my life can drive my life. Can drive me all day, not just till I get off my exit. Now I walk into the office and I'm mad. Damn kids today. How about those kids today? Parents just give them a car like that. And I'm steaming all the way to the coffee pot, and I'm steaming all the way back into my office, and my boss comes in and asks me a question. I jump at him, and now I'm in trouble at work. All because of a 16-year-old tailgater who's had his license for 27 days. Right? And here's the craziest thing. He wasn't tailgating me. He was following the car in front of him. You could have been driving it. You could have been driving it. It had nothing to do with me. I made it about me as soon as I reacted to it. Or that one about me at all. That's where I found out where my life was a mess. The way I reacted to things. My sponsor said, maybe if we can figure out how you're seeing things, we might change your perception in such a way that you can react differently to things. And we went all the way in the back of the book and it said something in there about a profound alteration in my reaction to life. A spiritual experience. So it is. What if you can profoundly alter the way you react to life? Anybody in here ever drink a lot of alcohol or take any illicit substances? That's what we were doing. Altering our reaction to life. Now we're being suggested we might want to do so spiritually instead of with substances and alcohol and all that. That's all it is. It starts looking so simple when I looked at it the way he showed me. So he said, we're going to get all this stuff down on a piece of paper because you already admit there's other things guiding your life. Let's find out what they are. So I wrote all the stuff down on a piece of paper, and he had me look at it. By the way, it's just a little trick for you sponsors. You know, we like to drag out the fourth step. You know, well, I'll do it. We'll do a fifth step next year sometime. You know, I've been working on my fourth step for 27 months. My sponsor's first guy that did this to me, he scheduled my fifth step before I even started the fourth step. We got it done kind of quickly then. Oh, yeah, we're doing your fifth step next Sunday. Be ready. I mentioned the tattoos and all. You know, I was ready. 17 years now, he's my sponsor. I'm thinking of getting rid of him any day now. He's just not a kind man. So we sit down, and we're going to do this fifth step. And he said to me, okay, now we're going to... He goes, now you're looking at all this stuff in one perception. I'm going to look at it, he, my sponsor, from a different perspective and maybe have a little bit different view. We had a different view on every single line of that thing, folks, I must say. But he helped me see things differently. Many of you are familiar with Chuck C's book, A New Pair of Glasses. And the title, of course, means nothing more than maybe there's a different way of looking at things. Maybe whatever's going on in life, there might be a different way of looking at things. See, guys, I tend to see the world not as it is, but as I am. If I'm running around angry and scared, you know what I see? A mad, scary world. And I'll get it before it gets me. That's the way I ran around for the longest time. I'm running around guilty and ashamed, and what I saw was a world that can't wait to put me down. And I got resentful and bitter and hid away in a closet. He was suggesting that if I could change me, the world would look very, very different. I wonder if there's anybody in here like me. Some days it's Christmas, it's Wednesday afternoon, it's Christmas season. You go to the mall. You can only find one parking place, but the store you need is way at the other end of the mall. So we go in the mall, and on this particular Wednesday, it's crowded. Everybody's in my way. Everybody's in my way. I don't know about you, but I always get the lady with the triple stroller. You get them? The Catholic lady? And the kid that can't hold on to his little tubey thing and he keeps dropping it and she stops and everybody crushes to a halt. They're in my way. They're all in my way. It's one way of looking at things. But the next Wednesday, I go to the mall, and I'm feeling a little bit more spiritually fit. Same crowd, same lady, same everything, and I'm flitting through that place like a fly. No big deal at all. Mall didn't change. People didn't change. The Catholic woman didn't change. Well, it's another week. She's probably got four of them babies now. But basically nothing's changed. Different perception, that's all. I'm seeing the world differently. I'm seeing the world as it is, not as I am. So Mike sat down, we did this little fifth step stuff, and you know what we found out? I found out an awful lot of stuff about me I didn't like very much. An awful lot of things about the way I think and view and interact in the world that I did not like very much. And I told him after the fifth step process, so I don't think I like who I am. No, my sponsor probably said something like, I don't blame you. He's not a nice man. But he sat down and he said, well, that's good, because that's what the next couple little steps we're going to take is for. We're going to take a look at that stuff that you don't like about you, that you've now satisfied yourself that is not working in your world. It's making you miserable, making you mad, making you scared, making you guilty, making you ashamed, bringing all kinds of remorse. And we're going to see if you might want to get rid of that stuff and change it. In my view, just my view, the sixth and seventh step is the whole key. It's also the part we skip over all too often. Like even those big, they call me a big book thumper. I'm a big book thumper. I kind of like that. They call me a big book thumper. I'm the guy in the meeting that, you know, I'm Dan. I speak up in a meeting. I'm Dan. I'm an alcoholic. And the eyes start rolling, you know. Oh, God, he's going to talk about the 12 steps again. Right here in our AA meeting, for God's sake, you know. Down in Delaware, see, we don't bother with all them steps and everything. We just go to a lot of meetings, and everybody's fine. I think we have 2,100 members in the state, and we have something like 400 and some meetings a week in one county alone. So we just keep adding more meetings. Now, I could do that, I suppose. I could go to 24 meetings a day, and I'd be fine. But I want to live out there. I love it in here. But I want to learn to live out there. We had a little thing we were talking just the other day. I was talking in Maryland the other night, and I just popped in and probably got me. I won't be invited back or here after this. But I was thinking, you're in your AA meeting and somebody says something like, really, knucklehead? And what do we say to them? Keep coming back. And when you're new, you think that's good. But let's face it, we only say that to the biggest knucklehead in the room at the moment. All right? So if you're new, if you hear keep coming back, yeah, we want you to keep coming back, but maybe a little quieter next time. All right? And then there was a fellow down there, 25 years sober, Jim, or something like that, and he told me, he said, when I first came in, there was this old timer, 30-some years. He goes, and Jim, being new, he goes, I would share it every meeting. I just wanted to share all that I had found in a few months' time. So he's talking every meeting. He said, after the meeting, this old-timer guy would always come up to me, and he'd say, Jim, thanks for sharing. You really helped me out. Jim took that to mean he was sharing sobriety and helping this old-timer guy out, and I'm going to talk even more. And it was only a few months later that he heard the old-timer say in a meeting, he comes to the meetings to hear the real sick ones, because that's what helps him the most. So Jim finally caught on. But anyway, just keep coming back. Think about this. When we first get here, we'll hear keep coming back. Now, we do mean it. You know, we do. We've all been new, all of us. So we obviously do mean it. But here's the neat part. In our recoveries out there, in the bigger part of our lives, are you hearing keep coming back? Are you hearing it out there? That's the secret. And they don't say keep coming back. My office, nobody ever says keep coming back. But only recently my boss did call me in. I'm not bragging, just saying this is the way it is. And he said, you do a really good job for the company. We're happy to have you. I heard keep coming back. And they meant it. Or the neighbor says, you know, we like having you in the neighborhood. You help out and you share and you contribute and all that. It's nice to have you as a neighbor. That's keep coming back. So when I start hearing it out there, I know I'm getting a little bit better. And for me, it's because of that sixth and seventh step. Mike sits me down, we look at the sixth and seventh step, and he says, decide what you want to keep and what you want to get rid of, basically. And I said, well, God's going to take this stuff away? He said, kinda. I always like this stuff. It's a little mystical. My sponsor believes, and I so often also believe, that God, power, creator, divine, whatever you want to call it, will not take something away from me that I will not let go. So if I insist on being a selfish son of a something, God's not going to suddenly look down and say, oh, there's Dan, let's make him generous. It's not going to happen. But what if I was to consciously practice the opposite of what I'm trying to get rid of? What if I consciously every morning said, all right, I'm dealing with selfish. I've got to be generous today. I'm going to throw a bucket in the charity basket. I'm going to let somebody in off the ramp. I'm going to do this. I'm going to help at work. I'm going to share lunch. I'm going to buy lunch. And at the end of the day, you know what happens? Not only am I practicing generosity and less selfishness, but somebody somewhere during the course of the day is going to say, keep coming back. That's recovery that I searched for, that Mike told me I could have. So we do those steps, and then he said, well, we got another little problem. We have other steps for it. He said, Dan, how do you feel about the way you lived out there when you're out there running around? I said, I was really ashamed and felt very, very guilty, very, very guilty for what I had become and the way I had lived and what I'd done to those children and my neighbors, employers. I wasn't ready to get out there and face the world. There were certain places I didn't want to go, certain people I didn't want to run into. I stole a lot of money, all kinds of things. The IRS, forget it. I learned when you own a business and you take withholding taxes from your employees, you're supposed to send that in. I don't remember them teaching me that part. I was a bad employer. I have to tell this fast story just because I like telling. I like how I tell it. There was a girl that worked for me at one of my stores. I had some sick. I've had some health stuff from my drinking, and I went and I'm sober 8 years, 9 years, whatever it might have been. I go up to this hospital in Philadelphia, and I need to have a procedure done. And in this procedure, they use things to enter your body in places that were not used to being entered. Is that clear enough for even for out there? All right. So anyway, I'm not too happy about doing this, but I realize I have to do it. So I'm sitting in the little waiting room in my little paper gown, and in comes this woman carrying this thing. And instead of saying, hello, Mr. McHugh, I am nursing, she says, oh, hi, Dan. Now, I don't know why, but I knew I was in trouble right then. I said, hello. She said, you don't remember who I am. Yeah. I said, no. She says, I'm Susan so-and-so. And she told me who she was. She says, I worked at your Milltown Road location some years back. And I said, good for you. You got a good start, you know, made a little money, went to nursing school. She said, you fired me. Did I mention the javelin she was holding? And I said, what? And she said, I guess I don't remember it. I went into one of the stores one day. I was probably hungover, drunk, whatever. And I just fired half the front end. I just, that's it. You guys over there are done. You guys over there. I was like that. I did that. When I finally did leave that place, I called my brother to verify. And he said, yes, you did, in fact, do that on more than one occasion. So now I got this girl. She's got this flagpole thing, all right? The term direct amends comes to mind. So you never know when. You know what? She was wonderful. She really was. She was really great and helpful. And she actually said, Evan, I wish she hadn't said that. She was actually, what you did to me helped me go get another job so I'd never have to work for someone like you again. All right. True story. Nice gal. Whew, that could have gone a lot of different ways, though, you know. So my sponsor said, you know, you got all this guilt going, this shame. He said, I don't think you're going to be able to walk around out there in that world like that. I said, I don't think so either. Now, I know people will tell us, well, forgive yourself. I'm one of these guys who can't, it just didn't work for me. I was taking a task only the other day at a meeting, a young gal with 4 or 5 hours sober blasted me for saying that I could not forgive myself. She says, I've already forgiven myself. And I said, well, that's wonderful, I hope. But she was so angry about it. I'm not quite sure it was true. But I'm not one of these guys say, okay, I stole your $20, but I forgive me. It doesn't make a lot of sense, all right? But what if I can give her the $20, maybe the $2 interest, over time or right now? Now I can forgive me. Now I can feel a little better, and I don't have to worry about running into you out in town or whatever. And I had those all over the place. Big, big dollars, little bitty dollars, monies, things I'd done, cars I'd dented, this and that and the other, all kinds of crazy things. He said, if we can systematically kind of get those out of your life, your perception of this world is going to change and change mightily. It's going to be a world out to get you anymore. You don't have to feel humiliated. You're going to to make it right to the best of your ability. And that's what I did. It took a long time. I'm still not finished. It's, well, over 17 years now, and this year or maybe next, everything will be paid. I wanted to file personal bankruptcy. That's what I wanted to do when I got sober. How about personal bankruptcy, Mike? Don't say that to sponsors. They don't do personal bankruptcy law. I said, how about a drink, Dan? Because that's where you're going if you don't fix this. So I had to go out and fix what I broke. Not just say I'm sorry. Much, much more than that. An amend, like making something right. Anyway, he had me do that. That took some time. Still finishing it. And then we get on to this 10-step. I didn't understand it. He said, Dan, all that really is everything you've done thus far rolled into one. Look at it. Look at the words. All where I'm asking you to do is to assess, take a little inventory if you want, share it with somebody, change your thinking if it needs to be changed. If you broke something, fix it. That's all we're asking you to do in this little step. He said, this is a little step for you. He goes, you're going to start living the program now. You're going to start living the program. So now he said, so we've got you from an unconscious contact with God, don't do that, to living the program to some degree. Let's see if we can't deepen that contact with God and make it a very conscious thing. To do that, we're going to use a couple of the oldest tools in the book. Prayer, meditation. Now in our books, you know, our guys who wrote this program, they weren't the most educated scholars about such things, but they gave us a few suggestions, and most of us over time go out and find something that works just as well or better to deepen that relationship with God. And then he said in the 12th step, so then we can go out, talk about it like we're doing tonight, try to help somebody, and the most important thing for me is to do it out there. It's pretty easy in here. I mean, we love each other. Okay, we have a great time. But most of my life is out there. And I even found a place in our literature, I didn't even know it was in there, which says that this wonderful fellowship, great as it is but a small segment of my life. That's where I got to learn how to do it. It's a little harder out there. It's a little bit harder. So my view of the 12 steps and how I was taught the 12 steps may or may not have been different than what others might have seen. But when I first got here, I would have told you, well, I guess the 12 steps are for stopping drinking. And I've since discovered that's not what the 12 steps are for at all. The 12 steps are for replacing my drinking. AA is not a not drinking program, which is kind of odd because we do measure success in how long since you've had a drink. And we'll hear some guys say, 17 years. And we'll also hear people say, 31 years, what's it to you, right? We know those two. So somebody suggested to me a long time ago, you want to have some fun, I shouldn't do this because you don't get invited back anymore, but if you, instead of just saying how long you're sober, here's what you can say. I don't say how many continuous days of sobriety have you had. Ask folks, how many continuous days of serenity have you had? Ah, now it opens up some stuff. How many continuous days of serenity have I had? Now, are we going to be able to do that every day? Not yet. Maybe someday. But that's my goal. So the 12-step program is not a not-drinking program. It's a life-changing program. And it's the process. It's not mystical. It didn't come down. Some of you know me. I love to study the history of AA. And I got books on it. I just love to study all the old influences and all this kind of thing. This stuff did not suddenly float in anybody's lap. This stuff's been around forever. For whatever reason, when we package this stuff into this thing, a little 12-step process, it tends to work for guys like me. Didn't even exactly, to this day, maybe nobody can explain exactly why. But it tends to work for me now to take these spiritual tools and use them to get in touch with some kind of a power that can solve my problem. Whole different way of looking at it. So when I work with somebody new, if there's new people in here, or maybe people sponsoring, the first thing I do is sit them down and ask them if they think they're screwed. And then I explain it to them. See, I know in my area, here's what we'll hear. I shouldn't cut up my area. But I can't cut up your hair because you're here. And they're not. But in some areas, the new guy will come in, and you know what we'll say to him? We'll say, don't drink, and go to a meeting. And that's all we say to him. Don't drink, and go to a meeting. And the reason I don't say that, and I don't mean to insult anyone, please, who may find that helpful, and maybe it is. But in my experience, the first step says, I can't not drink. That's why I got here. So when you tell me don't drink and go to a meeting, you've set me up for failure on the first half already because I'm here because I can't not drink. Go to a meeting. You ever notice how many newcomers will say, come to a meeting every day, and over time you give it. But most of them, and I guess we can all agree to this, most people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous stop coming. That's sad. Most people. We tell them don't drink, and we say come to a meeting, but most of them stop coming. If we think about the second part of the first step, which means even though I have all kinds of evidence to the contrary, when I'm sick and when I'm new, particularly, I make decisions based on things that aren't true. My life is unmanageable. So you say go to a meeting and we'll help you out, and I will for a little while, but here's what happens. I start believing things that aren't true. Those people don't like me. I'm not like them. He looked at me funny. He wouldn't sponsor me. I called him once this morning at 4:30. He didn't answer. Did you leave a message? No. Not doing that. Why'd he put his name on the list? You know, we have. I'm not like that. I'm going to do it over here. I'm going to go over there. The TV's on. The game is on. I'll go tomorrow. I'll go in the morning. So unfortunately, in my view, if I just say to the new guy, just don't drink and go to a meeting, I've unfortunately set him up for failure. And he's going to fail. And then I'll very glibly stand back and say, you know what? Guess he didn't want it bad enough. Guess he didn't want it bad enough. But if I can sit him down and open the doctor's opinion and say, you're screwed. First of all, he's going to smile. Maybe. It's according to how big he is, how I say it. If he's big, I call Mike. But if we can convince the new guy, and ourselves, I guess, that we are totally screwed without this, we're going to be more interested in this if we can do that. If we can understand that the second step is something that I take based on other people's experience, on belief only, which is just, what do I believe? What do I think right now? Okay, I'm going to change my thinking. Faith comes later. Faith comes later. I always say that the belief for me is I have a large screen television, and it goes on the blink. I don't know what to do with it. So I'm trying to figure out how to fix my large screen TV. And it suddenly occurs my neighbor Joe up the street has a large screen television. So I go up to Joe and I say, Joe, you got a large screen television. I remember a while back it went on the blink. What did you do, Joe? He said, I called Al's TV repair. He's down on Main Street. Give him a call. He fixed it up nice, good price. So I came to believe, based on Joe's experience, that if I called Al, I might also get a good price to get my TV fixed. So I came back down to the house, I called Al, he comes to the house, he gets the TV fixed, he gives me a good price, and voila, it's working. Everybody's happy. So I took the second step in TV repair. A couple months down the road, my TV goes bad again. This time, TV's been working good. I don't have to go on just belief of somebody else's experience. This time, I can go on the faith of my own experience because I've gotten results before. So this time, I make a decision based on the results I've gotten, the positive results I've gotten before, and I take the action that might work. And that's how our program goes, and on and on and on and on and on. So I explain that to the new guy, and I ask him to choose. Choose what you want to do here. I don't ask him to turn his life over to God in the third step or any. Gosh, I'd still be there if I was trying to do it. I was not able to do that. To this day, I can't do it very well, but I'm getting better at it. But I did say make a decision between being screwed and following what we did and trying to get some spiritual help. And if you do that, and if you can say, believe that there seems to be something out there. I used to hear it described as a perfect signal, like a TV signal. The signal is sent out from the radio station absolutely perfect. It's a perfect, strong signal. The problem is our TV sets. And we all have a different kind of receiver. But if the signal isn't coming in nice and strong, we got some little tools and knobs and things on the bottom. In the old days, horizontal hold, vertical hold, and I'm dating myself, and color and brightness and tint and all these things. So we got some tools to tune the signal in closer. We have the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have fellowship. We have service. We have prayer. We have meditation over here. We have prayer over here. We have picking up the knucklehead over here. Taking the phone call over here. Sponsorship back here. And then we get that thing coming in clear as a bell. I love this program. It's a way of life. It really is. And the process itself just seems to work for people like myself who have alcoholism. So I sit down with the new guy and I walk him through it just kind of like what Mike walked through with me. And I'll tell you what we usually see is a tremendous amount of younger people getting sober. We see a tremendous amount of younger people getting sober. And we sit and we write an inventory and we do the fifth step. And we find out that AA is a wonderful, wonderful design for living. And that if I can do these things as prescribed, I will have a profound alteration in my reaction to life. And I can be okay. You know, I do believe this. Before I close, I believe, sadly, most of the people who leave us, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I don't think most of the people who leave us, who come here and go out and drink, I do not believe they leave to get drunk because they want to be drunk. I suspect they leave because they're so darn uncomfortable sober. And even though we know how bad drunk is, if sober's bad enough, we'll go back to drunk. In the doctor's opinion, I think they called it restless, irritable, discontent. They're describing the sober condition. So if sober's bad enough, I'm going back to drunk. What if sober was perfectly comfortable no matter what was going on in life? What if everything that came on in life, no matter what happens in my life, I've learned I can mitigate it? Sandy Beach used to talk about this beautifully. Something happens in my life that's very painful. It hurts a lot. Most things that happen in life I can handle. But here's what happens. This event happens, I get mad. Now the pain's a little greater. I get resentful. Now the pain's a little greater. I get scared. Now the pain's a little greater. Now I'm not so sure I can handle it. A little too much. Now, I could have handled just the event. But what if I take the event, the painful event happens, and I say a prayer, a little lighter. I pick up some knucklehead and bring him to the rooms, a little bit lighter. Little meditation, a little bit lighter. Pick up after the meeting, a little bit lighter. I can handle that. I can handle that readily. I often hear people talk about balance. It's another one of my pet projects in AA. We always say that. Oh, I can't balance my new guys. I can't seem to balance my life in AA. Like it's two separate things. Like it's separate. If you think about balance, I just had a friend talk about this with my friend Rich the other day. If you think of a scale, balance is opposing forces. Trying to even out opposing forces. That's not what we're trying to do here. That's not what I want to do in here. I want to blend it. I want to blend it so that when I'm out at the shopping mall, or I'm up there on the street, or I'm on the job, or I'm doing this, or I'm doing that, I take the stuff you taught me with me and put it in my daily life. It changes everything. That way I can, in fact, react profoundly different than I once did in life, and I can be perfectly comfortable in sobriety. And ladies and gentlemen, if we can be perfectly comfortable day to day in sobriety, we don't need to take a drink of alcohol. Thank you.